Уважаемые участники и гости форума,
session. The session's title is The Experience of the Special Military Operation and Its Impact on Wars. The speaker is a Russian military journalist, blogger, public figure, and expert Yuri Padalyaka.
Здравствуйте.
Hello.
Пришел?
Thank you all for coming.
Уже здесь, наверное, эту тему задевал.
I touched upon this subject here yesterday, and we'll talk in depth today. The special military operation is not just going to have an impact on the wars of the future. We are witnessing how a new approach to wars is developing. The world is transforming the way it's approaching wars. The Bretton Woods system and the financial system, the political system that was formed in Potsdam are also going through a change. They don't seem to work. And we realize that a new system will come to replace them. Who's going to build it? That's what the fight is for. Just prior to entering this building, we discuss this with Yuri Pronko at the Tsarigrad studio. How can we figure out who is winning, who has won in this transformation of the world? What are going to be the forces that will write the rules for the next 60, 70 years for the rest of the globe? If we are the ones who will be writing these rules, we are going to, of course, write those rules for ourselves to fit our needs. And it's better than the case where others would be writing it for us. Why is this the case? Is this because Russia is good and we are superior to others? No, it's because the contradictions have come to the head. And we see everywhere that the events that are happening in the United States, right in front of our eyes in Los Angeles, are not initiated by anyone, by the internal contradictions that exist in the American system. So the American society is no longer a monolith it used to be, because there are some contradictions that cannot be resolved in principle. So Russia and Ukraine are one of the front lines of this repartitioning of the world that we are taking part in, and the hostilities of this scale had not occurred anywhere since World War II. I think in terms of casualties, this approaches the casualties in the Korean War, not counting, of course, the casualties suffered by the Chinese in the hostilities of that time. We saw a number of factors that emerged during the special military operation. And of course, the Korean War was the follow-on to the Second World War. But this one, this war, is very different. The war in 2022 and the war now are two different wars. So you can see that all. This is not just something that you can figure out from reading the reports. I've spoken with the instructors, and I have been making my own conclusions. And we all come to the same conclusion. If someone hadn't been to the front line in half a year, is not any longer prepared to fight effectively. So the risks are going up to get wounded and not to perform the mission. So you can imagine the speed of the change that is occurring before our eyes. Just 3 years ago, they did speak about UAVs, the drones. They said that they are going to be a helping factor, but now it's the main factor of inflicting damage. And of course, cyber technologies have really made leaps and bounds in terms of their integration into the warfare. And that's how it's going to go in this war. It is possible that AI will be involved in making decisions, but for now it's man who is making decisions. But the cyber systems are involved in hostilities. And the only role that is assigned to the infantrymen is to
артиллерии,
basically dug in and occupy the land. Of course, artillery is important, but the robots are playing an increasingly important role. Things are going to evolve this year. A lot of things are going to implement it. That would include land robots. There are sappers. There are demining robots. Artillery is not robotized yet, but some progress has been made in that area as well. So it is quite possible that we will see that supplies are going to be provided to the front line by drones, either by aerial drones or by land-based drones, because if we are to involve people in that, we are going to suffer casualties. Another big problem is rotation of personnel. We can talk about this right now, but before the operation in Suja, before Suja was liberated, we had a crisis of sorts in the south, on the border with the Belgorod region, near Demidovka and Bogovka. There was a salient that the enemy built there, so we had to deploy our troops to that location, and the commanders that were online said that they had involved people in an offensive operation. They had accumulated a number of forces there over a period of 10 days. They, of course, suffered casualties. If they were to remove people there from that location quickly, they would suffer more casualties. It wouldn't make any sense. So right now, storming is not the most important thing. Salt is not the most important thing. The most important thing is to provide people with the necessary supplies before the assault begins. And that is something that is the most difficult thing to organize. So we are using basically the concept of the scorched earth so that we could deprive the enemy of the ability to maneuver. And those who can do this better, those are the ones who will be having the upper hand. And that's how we won the battle in Suja. Now, certain things cannot be said, but for you to understand, let me just mention, after the Suja operation, when I got there, not quite officially, but we were able to observe what's going on, I was interested in figuring out how the fight had been proceeding. But there were no battles for the settlements in the Suja region. It was not a classic storm or assault. It was a traditional kind of operation that ended with the liberation of the city without an assault, per se. That's how it was. That's the truth. And of course, information campaign played another important role in this. And I hope that this experience is going to be used going forward. The information part of any operation is quite significant and important. We saw that in 2022 when every battle would give rise to rumors, fake news, to augment the effect of a blow. If we hadn't been successful on the battlefield, we could basically inflict more panic by using information campaigns. And later on, when we can disclose certain details of the operation, then we could talk about that. But basically, we scared the enemy, and the enemy left without really a fight.
So,
all countries of the world are learning from this experience. This experience is invaluable, not just for us, but for everyone. If someone misses out on this opportunity to learn from this experience, they will lose everything. Syria is a good example. Assad's regime couldn't care less about what was going on in Ukraine, didn't make any conclusions, and 300 bandits basically destroyed all of the systems. 300 people only took part in the assault, and Assad's army accounted 200,000, And they had 30,000 people on the front line. So the ratio was 1 to 100. But
и второй момент, наводя волну паники.
They were able to inflict panic, and of course they had the aerial dominance and supremacy during the first flight, and they were able to topple the regime, being down 1 to 300 as far as the ratio goes.
Сейчас не так.
So the number of troops doesn't matter that much as the ability to provide enough supplies and to provide enough information support for the actions performed on the battlefield. So that's something we need to pay attention to. That's the skill we need to develop further. And of course, we need to train our troops to be fighting in a new war. I've been at testing grounds and proving grounds, and I see that we are still
передним краем, потом ребята не стал
teaching our troops to fight in a war that they will not see on the front line. And our enemy has the same problem. That's the problem countries in Europe face. I'm talking about the way the new recruits are trained, and the military are not, you know, coping with the speed of change on the battlefield. That's expected. I'm not suggesting that that our military academies could broadcast this knowledge in the near real-time mode. That's impossible. That's something that shouldn't be expected. But despite the development of technologies in the 21st century and contactless wars, we still see gunfights and artillery fights, and we need to be ready for that as well. And that completes my brief talk. If you have any questions, that would be easier for me. And we have only 20 minutes for this. So I've spoken for 12 minutes. If there are any questions, it'll be my pleasure to take your questions and answer them.
Micro.
Здравствуйте, меня зовут.
Hello, my name is Svetoslav.
Вот идет война, можно сказать, которая.
Right now, this war.
И эта война судьба всего мира.
Is deciding the fate of the world.
Сейчас.
It will decide many things in the world. It's also a war of information technologies.
Война идет.
It's an info war. It's also a war of technologies.
Появляются новых технологий.
So new technologies are emerging.
Мы победим.
So my question is, how can we win? How are we going to celebrate this victory? And what
технологии для войн будут?
Technologies are going to be used in wars of the future, and what weapons are going to be used? Thank you.
Ну, знаете, как будем отмечать победу? Для начала надо.
Well, before we start celebrating the war, we need to win. It's a little bit premature to talk about that. You probably didn't listen to me attentively. Many things that you are talking about are changing right before our eyes. There's a high probability that in a year's time the war will continue in a year's time, unless basically the enemy crumbles. So it's hard to say what technologies are going to be the winning technologies. We see that the cyber technologies are getting increasingly more involved in the war, and that's going to continue. Where this ends, I don't know, because we don't know when this war is going to end. We don't know which tech solutions are going to be used. Let's, you know, roll back to a year before, the beginning of 2024. Since then, a lot have changed. And if we roll things back a little bit more, we'll see things even further changing. And if the work goes on for one more or 2 years, things are going to change. There is no answer to your question. Anyone who will tell you that they know how this will pan out, he's not saying the truth. My name is Vitaly. My call name is Abzats. I'm one of your followers. I participated in the special military operation. I got back recently. I have a specific number of questions. The troops are awaiting a mobilization. What do you think about this? What have you heard in your circles about mobilization? And that's my first question. The second question is, can our war correspondents raise the question of, you know, bringing some order to providing leaves for the military that are in the trenches for 2 years? Some of them never got any leave over the 2 years. So when those that signed contracts, they were promised 2 vacations a year, but in reality, it's not more than one vacation of 15 days, including 2 days. I hope that you're going to be brave enough and raise this issue here. Well, I don't need to be brave, because I have been writing about this in my blog. If you read it, you know that I have been raising this matter over a year. And no one is thinking about mobilization in Russia. You probably didn't see that. There is no bravery that's needed. This is not something that is being raised. As for the leaves for the military troops, this is a decision of the troop commander. There are those who have no problem with the leaves, and there are units that do not get leaves. As for the contracts, and the conditions of the contracts and the, you know, fulfilling the obligations under the contract, that all differs. Regions need to provide a certain number of people, and they don't care how they do this. And very often they cajole people into doing that. That's the case. And I'm not a war correspondent. Some people think that I'm that, but I'm just a war blogger. And a military correspondent is a different profession, not mine. We have frequent meetings with the Minister of Defense, and we raise this matter quite often. We raise this subject, and people are trying to make a change there. But again, it's the military commander of a particular unit that makes decisions regarding leaves, and they can always substantiate their decision. You know, I have been at odds with the command of the 25th Army that have been deceiving everyone. And that's why their neighbors cannot really fight effectively. And they've really poured a lot of bad things about me, on me.
Yuri Ivanovich, здравствуйте.
Yuri, my name is Gleb.
Сейчас начали снова активно говорить о возможности...
They're now talking about... An attack of the Kiev regime against the Transnistria region, where we have military bases and some military troops there. What do you think? Is this possible that the Kiev regime might attack Transnistria? And if not, Mr. Lavrov said yesterday that Odessa is the Russian city. And when it becomes that again, do you think that after we reach Transnistria, we will inevitably have a conflict with the regime in Kishinev? If we get to Transnistria, and I do hope we will get there, there will be no conflict with the Moldavian regime, because the ratio of forces is incomparable. So that's going to be a fact that the government of Moldova will have to deal with. But we are still learning from the mistakes that we had made in the past. Well, that's the fact. You cannot escape that. And when we get there, there is a political task that has been set along those lines. Then that means there will be a different reality there, not just in Moldova, but in the entire area. That will change the balance of power in the Balkans. And the young man over there.
Yuri Ivanovich, добрый день.
Mr. Padalyaka, good morning. Let me ask you this question. I have 3 questions.
Россия,
what is Russia going to do if the European countries enter the war on the side of Ukraine, whether it's on the territory of Ukraine or on the territory of their own countries, let's say in the Baltics or elsewhere? Do you think that such a threat does exist? And the second question is,
по вашему мнению, докуда?
How far do you think we need to go in order to eradicate this evil?
Да.
Yes.
Третий вопрос.
And the third question is, how long will all of this take so that Russia could definitely say, that's it. After this, we'll have peace. And any agreements we have with the West are going to be adhered to. And we'll have similar to Minsk agreement, but the ones that will be fulfilled.
The first question, is there any threat from the West? Well, the West is on war with us, but on the territory of Ukraine. The West, well, actually has sent their troops there as well, starting from 2014, and there are more and more combat units. This is an open secret. Officially, the West is not launching, is not sending its troops. Otherwise, they understand there will be huge losses. As the experience has shown, we can incur such losses, and the Russian society is quite tolerant to that, but the Western society probably would not tolerate such losses. I don't think that we would enter the territory of other countries. That doesn't make any sense, because we first have to fix all the problems on our own territory, in Ukraine. How far we can go? There should not be Ukraine as a state with the Russian and Polish army being stationed as border guards. And I do think that the optimal solution would be the old Polish border of 1939, so there should be no Ukraine between Poland and Russia. I'm not celebrating such an idea that this border should be like that, but this is the most rational solution. That we still have to fight to reach that goal. How far the war can last? It depends on how many mistakes we can commit. I think it has become obvious that the winner would be the side that commits less mistakes and that learns to fix them fast. We fix our mistakes, but we do not do that as fast as we want it. And we suffer a lot of losses just because we are fixing the problems too slow. And for instance, on the front line, the units that advance quite fast and do not suffer heavy losses. But there are units and components that actually are launching kind of a means grinding assaults, suffering heavy losses. And this is the general staff that has to take such decisions and ask that question every now and then, and they do not listen to me very often. In the army, there will be one or two units that is quite capable to fight. In the modern terms, is capable of advancing and waging a real effective war. But as for the rest, unfortunately, other units are not capable of fighting, not ready to fight. So, for instance, let's have a look at the Third Army. So the most able to fight unit is Brigade number 2. And there was an old commander there, and he was replaced, and some improvements are being done, but very slowly. And the same is true for other troops as well. What can we do about that? Only the top political leadership can solve that problem, can take a decision. Why? Probably it will never happen. No, no, there is a big difference.
You
named all the mistakes that an inexperienced politician may commit, so let's make a strike, but without thinking why we do that. We could have killed Zelensky about 20 times, for sure. But why? What for? Zelensky is the most beneficial for Russia, president of Ukraine. There is no one better than Zelensky if Beletsky comes to power, but we don't need that circus because they would commit less mistakes, there would be less corruption, the regime would be stronger, and would be more difficult actually to ouster that regime. So we're not killing Zelensky because he is the most advantageous for Russia president of Ukraine. So I do think that the British would kill him eventually. Thank you so much.